You to open a Bible, whether you do that on an electronic device or if you didn't bring a Bible of some kind, there are some on the chair racks. And if you're turning to the book of Ruth in those Bibles, it's found on page 182. If you're not familiar with where Ruth is, a small book, you go through Genesis and a bunch of books and then you'll hit Judges. That's a pretty big one. It's right after that. If you get to a numbered bunch of books like 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Kings, and Samuel, those, you've gone too far. Turn left, and it's a little book in between those, and we're looking at Ruth today, chapter 2. So I want you to follow along. It'll also be up on the screen. We're looking at Ruth, chapter 2. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go into the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and entered into a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted his harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they answered. Boaz asked the overseer of his harvesters, "Who does this young woman belong to?" The overseer replied, "She is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She came into the field and has remained here from morning until now, except for a short rest in the shelter." Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with the women who work for me. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the women. I have told the men not to lay a hand on you, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she asked him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about you and what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have put me at ease by speaking kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it into the wine vinegar." And when she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Let her gather among the sheaves and don't reprimand her. Even pull some of the stalks out from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up and don't rebuke her." Ruth gleaned in the field until evening, and then she thrashed the barley that she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "He even said to me, 'Stay here with my workers until they finished harvesting all of my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. The word of the Lord. The setting of our story today is on a farm, and I'm curious because I suspect the number is pretty high, and you can look around. How many of you have worked at some point in your life on a farm? Go ahead, look around. Yeah, a lot of us. Not long out of high school, I worked on a farm at one point, and it happened to be a pig farm. Now, this pig farm, they bought feeders and then raised them up kind of a thing, and so they would go all over the place and buy feeders, and when they did that, they had their own trucks, but they were double-decker trucks. Yeah, some of you know where this is going already. There's pigs on the top bunch, and there's pigs on the bottom too, right? And these little piglets are in there, wee, 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 squealing and everything. But somebody's got to get underneath that top deck and go in and chase those little piglets out. Well, guess who does that? The new kid on the block, right? Hey, Bernie, go in there and chase those little piglets out. Now, Naomi and Ruth, they went to go to this farmland to try and find favor. I'm telling you, about that time when I was underneath there, I was not finding much favor. Sometimes that's the way it is when you're in a farm or in a, even when you own one, it's not necessarily. Sometimes you wonder, this is God's favor that I'm facing? I suspect that Naomi and Ruth were not really necessarily feeling God's favor either. But the picture is about the change in the story. And it leads us to ask these questions then when we're wrestling with God's favor and how we find it. Who does God favor? Who is it that He favors? And why does He favor them? And what does His favor look like? How does that really show up in the midst of our lives? This story, the overall story, is about God's providence, His care for us, and it's expressed both through divine and human favor. And let's see how that shows up in the book here, in this chapter. Who does God favor first? Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but there's been numbers of studies that show that when you look at companies and who gets hired and who makes progression faster within the promotion and stuff, it's the tall and the thin and the good-looking who actually make faster hires and who get hired more easily, who make it quicker up the line and stuff. It's not that it means without exception, but the fact of the matter is there are those kind of measures that play into who advances and who goes forward. So is that the way God favors? Does He look like the world looks on the outward appearance? Well, we would say, no, we know that isn't the case, but it still leads us to the question, who does God favor? The talented, the hardworking? Does He favor the rich? Or by very contrast, does He know He doesn't favor that because the world does that? He favors the poor. Who is it that God does favor? Well, I want you to recount, because chapter 1 moves so fastly, and even in the first 5 verses, there's all these things that we're told there, that this family of 4 leaves Israel because of a famine. Okay, that's no fun. And they go to this land, which is not really a great place to have to go to. And they go there to try and preserve life, but in fact, of the 4, 3 of them die. Only one, Naomi, is left, and she, with just her daughters-in-law, and one of them abandons her. We just kind of read through that lickety-split, and we don't really enter into the pain that they were entering into, that they were feeling, that they were dealing with in their lives. But if we were making a movie of this, all of that first chapter would be being played with the background music in the minor chords. It's sort of this dirge, and it's not very fun, and it's awful. And all of a sudden, the tune would change, and it would suddenly become much more light and much more delightful. And then all of a sudden, we would have this verse 1 come up, and here, hope all of a sudden begins to shine with the introduction of this man, Boaz. And so if we were doing it as a movie, he'd sort of come in, and we know then the way it's introduced. Here's the knight in shining armor. Here's the hero of the story. The story is about to change, and that's what takes place. And we're told that he is a man of standing. That's not just his wealth. It's about his character and who he is. And he's of the clan of Elimelech. Now, we find then that as the story goes, Ruth says she's going to go and glean, and she's going to look to pick up what gleaning is, then the leftover grain that is left behind. Let me help you understand the depth of their poverty and putting that in a modern day context. Here's what this gal is doing. It's like going out today and walking the ditches of the highway, picking up aluminum cans and taking that and turning it in to get the money, and that's what you're living on. That's how these two are going to work to be able to survive. That's the work that she's endeavoring to do. It's rough times. By contrast, so we would look at that and say, is that who God favors because she's poor? But look at, in contrast, that we see Boaz, this man of standing, and he is favored, but also Ruth says to him, who am I in verse 6? In verse 10, she says, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? She obviously sees him much different than who he is. But understand, this is what's going on here. When she asks, who am I that you would favor me? We find some very important clues to who God favors in Boaz's answer to her. Look with me at that answer. A careful unpacking of it helps us to see it. In verses 11 to 12, he answers. Boaz replies, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I want you to remember that phrase, not just today, hang on to it. May you be rewarded by the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Now, in addition to hanging on that phrase, what you want to understand from the overall way in which this is constructed and put together is that this language is modeled after language of when Abram ventured forth from Haran and went forth in faith to find a promised land. The author specifically uses language that brings to mind to the careful reader the idea that this woman ventured forth by God's direct intervention and work in her life, pulling her forward. So Boaz realized that she came for God's protection, to seek and to know God. He's understanding that the reason she's there is because she is one who came to become a follower of God. It isn't just about their works, in other words, and this is why Dallas Willard says, grace is not opposed to effort, it is opposed to earning. Earning is an attitude, effort is an action. We're going to understand that quote a little more as we continue to unpack this idea of who does God favor and why does he favor him? But understand this right now. Who does God favor? It's those who seek him by faith. The way that's phrased, it's very clear that it isn't about that she was a good worker or that she was disciplined, those things. It's that she came seeking God. It's not those who come to God for reward, in other words, as though he owes them something. It's those who come to him for him. Ruth sought God when she had lost everything, but she wanted him, not things to be taken care of. She said, remember, in the first chapter to Naomi, your God will be my God. That's what she was after. So what's the answer to the question, who does God favor? God favors those who seek him. That's who he favors. Not those who work hard, not necessarily. Not those who are rich or poor. He favors those who seek him. But that leads us then to unpacking that further into why does God favor him? Why does God favor those people? Now, when we read stories like this, we tend to think again, it's drilled into us, and I'm going to demonstrate that in a minute, that it is he favors them because they did good things. Well, she was a good woman. That's why he favored him. He was a generous guy. That's why God favored him. But we think that way because we're really good capitalists. Let me see if I can demonstrate that for you. How many of you grew up with your parents, or even you say it, well, they had us over for supper, so we have to have them over for supper, right? Am I the only one? You do that? You know, this Christmas, a neighbor from across the street came over right before Christmas and brought us, rang the doorbell, came and gave us some baked goods. She was no more than off of the step and going down, and what was going in my head? We didn't do anything for them for Christmas. You know, that's not a bad thing necessarily, and And I know that we've had that drilled into us our whole life, and we live it in lots of ways. But really, are you going to try and come to God that way? As though you can repay Him for what Christ did on the cross? Do we think this is about some capitalistic venture? That I did this, God, so don't you owe me that? Or I've received this, so now I have to pay that. You see, and if we're going to understand God's favor, we have to get out of the economic understanding of our everyday life. Is His economy is so different from ours. We cannot approach God that way. But yet good works abound in the story. So what do we do with those? Notice verse 5. Who does that young woman belong to? Boaz asks. And the servant answers, well, she's the Moabite that came with Naomi. Now the servant, notice, even knows who she is. Ruth is known about the town. Now it's a small town. You know, by the way, just as an aside, the definition of a small town, don't you? A small town is where you go out and you get stuck in the ditch 5 miles from town. By the time the wrecker gets you pulled out and you get back to the cafe in town, everybody there knows it. Some of you experienced that kind of thing in a small town, and that seems to be what was happening here. Ruth's reputation was known. Now notice in verses 6 and 7, we find that she's polite, she's diligent, she's a hard worker. All of these are seen in that description. But even more than that, look down at verse 14. I mean, here's this woman. She and her mother-in-law barely surviving. But she ate, and it noticed she had some left over. Now, how do we know that? Obviously, somebody saw it. But she had this little bit of lunch, and yet she took some of that lunch, and she put it away in her pocket. And that was seen that she did that. And she put that away. Now, what was she putting it away for? We know what she was putting it away for, because verse 18 tells us. It says that she gave those leftovers to Naomi when she got home that night. What amazing character. And her generosity, even in the midst of her poverty. But Boaz, too, demonstrates lots of good works. Notice that he says to her, verse 8, stay here with the women. He makes her nearly a worker in the way he explains, stay with the women. It's like the gleaners were supposed to stay well behind those who were harvesting, so they didn't get grabbing it too quickly. And she is invited to come up with them. And then notice verse 9, drink our water. Now look at the labor that would be involved in having to leave the field, quit your work, go and grab the water, and then come back and start working again and doing that. But he says, no, come and drink the water that I've paid to get for my workers. And then notice verse 14, if that's not radical enough, look what happens next. Come, he says, and have some lunch. Are you kidding me? Somebody who is here begging in his field, and he says, come and have lunch. And it isn't just that she can have any lunch and eat what she's been gleaning, but eat what I have had my servants prepare. Maybe my wife, or not wife, his servants, his workers prepare. And so here he is, he invites her in. But it isn't just enough that he invites her in. Notice verse 14 then, it says, eat these things, but then also he served her. You don't take a foreign woman, lowly person, and have her even sit with the servants, let alone sit with you. And if you're the wealthy landowner, you certainly don't serve her, but he did. He served her. And then, I'm speculating here, but I said, who was it that saw that Ruth took the leftovers and kind of slid them in her pocket? My great suspicion is that the person who really saw it was Boaz. And he recognized, are you kidding me? I give this young woman this lunch who's out here working, and she saves some of it for her mother-in-law, who's not working, by the way. And so then he says, right after verse 14 has told us that she saved some of the lunch. Notice what we're told in verses 15 and 16. My speculation is not without reason. Be messy harvesters, he says to them, so she can have more. As a matter of fact, even pull out some of the stalks after you've bound them and leave them on the ground for her. After you've done the work of cutting him and binding him up, pull some out and throw him down. Be messy. So she is generously provided for. Why these good works? Why these good works? Ephesians 2:10 says, Paul, looking back at the stories, he says, "For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which God has prepared in advance for us to do." Do you understand that the things that have been left on the ground for you, whether it's your workplace, your neighborhood, those workers that you hire, those people that you work with, he's laid those on the ground so that your good works would show him. That's why they're there. That's why his provision is there. That's why his providence has put you in that place. Even more directly, Jesus said, God favors us. How? With these opportunities for good service. For what purpose? Let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Why do we do good works? That God's glory would be seen. But remember, don't go too quickly past the idea that Ruth was suffering. How humiliating to have to go out and glean. Here's what we need to understand about God's favor. Sometimes he favors us with suffering. He doesn't just favor us with good things. It is his favor that we would suffer. And when we see it as such, we understand much greater who God is and what he's doing. You see, God favors people for his own glory. Yet we find ourselves, and we all do, I get it. I ask the questions too. Why am I facing this? Why isn't my life going the way I thought it was going to go? In his little booklet, The Question That Never Goes Away, Philip Yancey writes, oddly though, while giving Job, that's the story that he uses to be able to unpack the question why, because it is the most astounding story in Scripture about why. But here's what he says. He gives him a natural tour of the magnificent world in magnificent poetry, but God never addressed the why question with him. In Frederick Buechner's words, as a matter of fact, God doesn't explain, he explodes. He asks Job who he thinks he is anyway. He says that to try to explain the kind of thing Job wants to have explained to him would be like trying to explain Einstein to a little neck clam. God doesn't reveal his grand design, he reveals himself. Look at what's being told us here. I don't know if you've ever tried to understand the theory of relativity. It's pretty complex. Now try and tell that to a clam. That's what we're asking for when we say too much, God, why? So what is it that God, and who is it that God really favors? Who does God favor? First, those who seek him. But why does he favor them? So that we will seek him all the more. Not solutions, not always answers, not understanding necessarily, but that we would seek him. So what does that favor then look like? What does it really look like? It is both humbling and empowering. We find that come out in the story here. Notice first, humbling. Verse 13, we're told, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants. That's what she says. Ruth comes to this place. She doesn't expect to be provided. Now, please understand something. She had reason to expect that this would be provided. Did you realize that? Gleaning was a part of the law. There was a provision in Israel for this very thing to take place, but she comes and asks. She didn't come begging. She came respectfully looking. She had humility. See, entitlement is far from what God's favored people express. I'm amazed at how many times people will express something like, well, isn't the church supposed to be doing that for me? So somehow we've come to understand that the church is there to serve us, versus us be in the church to serve others. Entitlement mentality is something that is not just among a certain generation. We all have to wrestle with it. Humble people are astounded to receive favor. The proud expect it. Again, I point out in verse 14 that Boaz invited her to sit with them for lunch, and she is the one who is served. what we find there is that prejudice is obliterated from the heart of the humble. It isn't just that Ruth is one who is expressing that. Boaz is expressing it in a great way as he humbles himself. But in addition, God's favor is humbling, but it's also empowering. Remember, these ladies have been through a really tough spot, and they've been in that tough spot for a while. But in the shelter of his wings, we're empowered to take faith-filled risks. And that's what this story is going to go on to talk about. There's going to be more in which we see and we begin to really catch the idea that even in the midst of all that they have faced, here they are all of a sudden able to look outward and look at others. You see, God's favor, it looks like freedom from worry. Do you wrestle with worry? Do you wake up in the night with those things running through your head? But what about God's favor? Perhaps it's there that you would seek Him the more. God's favor looks to have our overdone self-confidence also and our self-doubt let go of. It's a freedom for radical generosity, for a grace-filled living, for no prejudice at all, for kindness to be expressed. Notice again verses 15 and 16. Let her gather among the sheaves. Don't reprimand her. Even pull out some of them, of the stalks, so that the bundles will be able to be there for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her. Though we live in a small town as well, I'm always amazed when I open up the paper, each week actually, and I open up the paper and I look through it, and I get to a spot where the Help Wanted ads fill about at least two pages on that little paper. It's amazing to me how many places are saying, Help Wanted, come and work for us, come and work for us. Even some of them, very big ads. It's amazing to me how much that is in there. But I want you to understand something, and we all have to work to be able to get this into our heads and to be able to really understand it. God has not hung up a sign, Help Wanted, as though He's desperate to try and get something done. He is not in that sort of capitalistic relationship with us. What He's looking for, and He is saying, is come find shelter that empowers you to risk everything and even to give it away, to understand hope in the midst of the worst of pain, to understand that the perplexities of life can have an incredible meaning as they point to me, not to what you think they're about to be about. See, then true life is seen in me. You can let go, He's telling us, of all the things that hold us back from a truly faith-filled, glorious life. And unless, please understand this, step back now from the story, look at it and look at your life. Unless you've come to know God's favor as a radical reorientation of your direction in life. In other words, if you're not wrestling with doing something very different from what everybody else around you is doing, unless there's some sense of figuring out how my life is different from everybody else around me, then I'm sorry, but you really need to step back and see if you're living in God's favor. See, unless we know God's favor as a radical reorientation of our priorities, then He isn't really being central in all that we do. Somehow we need to look at that. God's favor empowers the death of prejudice, of self-centeredness, of greed, of holding on to things, of looking to acquire stuff just in this life, of being unwilling to serve and sacrifice. It rather empowers us to be able to work into all of those things because we have a faith-filled risk adventure in us of what God is doing. I know that many of us didn't study the shorter catechism, and I don't know anything more about it, but I do know the first question, and it's very helpful to me to know about it. What is the chief end of man? It is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Say it. What is the chief end of man? It is not always to understand, is it? It is to be wrapped up in who He is. What does God's favor look like? It looks like a radical faith-filled risk for him to be seen in us, in all that we face, in everything that we do. The providence of God displayed through his favor lasts through the delights and the horrors. It sustains in the riches and in the poverty, in the health and in the sickness, in the perplexing things and in the seen things. God favors those who by faith take shelter under his wings, seeking him for who he is, not for what he gives us. Why does he do this? Because he is worthy of all glory. In other words, if we're favored, it is most expressed by the idea that we are believing God is being glorified in my life, whether by life, by death, by health, by whatever, that God is being seen. That's God's favor. And God's favor looks like a radical, reoriented life that really makes sure he's being seen. Not I'm just living in comfort. Not I'm just attaining all of these other things or whatever it is that is the normal path of life, but that God is being seen in all that I do. We have a long ways to go, don't we? I have so much to consider what that looks like. But I want to encourage you this day to say, is God's favor what I'm living for? And if it's not, with all that we do, then let's surrender those things that are holding us back. And if that's not even the beginning of your orientation of life, make that change this day. Let's pray.